The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski. Coming up.
So the messages can, if you are connected to the internet, go through the internet, obviously, but if you are not, they can just go from one phone to the other. And they can hop. So that means the message can go from one phone to another phone that goes to another phone. Okay.
Being able to instant message when all the networks are down is the Fire Chat app's USP. Creator Misha Benoliel tells us something about this game-changing communication tool for Android and iOS, and why, despite all evidence to the contrary, it's actually good for telephone companies. And speaking of telephone companies, British Telecom's broadband service had a major crash last week, and we'll be discovering whether BT's reaction was appropriate and if Twitter's reaction was proportionate. And are you feeling happy or sad? Answers to those questions turned out to be more thorny than you'd think, as a new psychology research study published this week exposed that the social network Facebook experimentally manipulated our feeds to learn about our emotions. This is a happy edition of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio this week is The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur, and The Guardian's crack tech reporter, Alex Hearn. Welcome to you. But that doesn't mean that you smoke crack, by the way, Alex.
It doesn't mean that I don't.
This is true. Hey, we're keeping it open. And Charles, do you smoke crack?
Not that I've noticed. I mean, I'm not Rob Ford. Though possibly I should, you know, maybe I'd become a mayor if I did.
Ah, very topical. Nicely done, Charles. And we're also joined by Juliet Garside. Juliet, thank you very much for coming in again. Do you smoke crack?
I haven't thought of an answer to that one. I'll get back to you.
All right. Well, we're going to kick off with the revelations that Facebook conducted an experiment on almost 700,000 of its 1.2 billion users for 1 week in January 2012 to understand how emotions might be contagions, even in virtual environments. Charles, what are Facebook up to?
What they were worried about, and it really was a worry, was that if people see sad or gloomy stuff on Facebook posted by their friends, that those people will go, this Facebook place is really depressing me, and not come back. And that would obviously hit Facebook's business model. They'd already done some research which was published in PLOS, which is an open source scientific publication, which showed that if it was raining in a city and people posted about that, then people who are friends of those people who saw those postings would go, man, I'm really down. It's raining in this other city that are nowhere near. And so they wanted to follow up with that by seeing what would happen if they manipulated the contents of people's news feeds so that they were a bit more of a downer or more of an upper, to see whether people would react in the same way or differently. The guess was that people would actually go, ooh, it's a bit of a downer here, and so actually I feel good. But what they found was that emotions are, in that sense, contagious. If you see other people being down, then you get a bit down. So they sort of proved that things you read on the internet affect your mental well-being.
Which is actually quite interesting, given that most of the research beforehand about what's called emotional contagion has very much been face-to-face. And in fact, the research study that has caused so much of a reaction across the social media references a 20-year longitudinal study that actually found that people, when they're physically proximate and somebody says, oh, I'm not feeling great, then the other person says, oh, I'm not feeling great either. I mean, there's all kinds of different levels to this story. And as I've mentioned across social media, this story really incenses me more possibly even than the newsfeed manipulation, just simply because it's asking questions about research ethics as opposed to anything else.
But it is the research ethics which is the big element of it. I mean, I think that if people understood that they were going to be part of an experiment on Facebook, where they said, you know, we may do things in the newsfeed, are you okay with that? And explicitly let people opt in or say, no, just, you know, leave my face, leave my newsfeed alone, then people will be, hey, that's great. That's a really interesting study you've done there. But it's the fact that people didn't have informed consent, which has got researchers a bit het up. And they're saying that if this had an effect, which was measurable, therefore you need to have informed consent. And the fact that you didn't have informed consent means that, in theory, it breaches ethics.
But the problem with having informed consent in this kind of study is that you prime people to expect some kind of manipulation. And so, therefore, it loses its what's called its sort of environmental or its naturalistic validity. So if I say to you, Charles, I'm going to manipulate you now, you're going to be like, right, I'm ready to be manipulated. And that's going to affect your behavior. What they were trying to do, arguably, in this study with the research question that they posed, is they were trying to see if, in fact, emotions, and by emotions, I don't necessarily mean how people actually felt, the types of things that they posted, which is different, was contagious. Whether, you know, people would say, oh, you're feeling down, I'm feeling down. So they couldn't tell people. And this is something that happens across psychology research all the time. They couldn't tell people that they were going to manipulate them because that would mean that it wasn't ecologically, environmentally, or naturalistically valid.
Now, in a second, I'd like to bring in someone who's done a doctorate on this called Alex Rutosky. But, I mean, the thing is that you see it with double-blind randomized studies of medicines. You know, people are opted in, people opt in to a trial, but they don't know if they're getting a dummy or if they're getting the real thing. And indeed, the people who are medicating them don't know either. So in that sense, we know that placebos do have an effect. You're just looking for a variation that's significant between the placebos and the non-placebos. Surely that's the thing. And I mean, I know that you did some of this sort of stuff in your doctorate. So tell us, why would one not do the equivalent of a randomized double-blind study?
It is very, very difficult to do such a thing in a 1.2 million person social network, because part of the thing is that you're also implicating all of the people whose posts you're asking people to respond to. Right. So if Alex and Juliet and Charles all posted something and I'm the person whose feed is being manipulated, then Alex and Charles and Juliet are also implicated because it's your posts that could potentially come into my feed,
but
which means that I would then
know
need to
that
get
your feed has been. You've consented to take part, but you don't know.
But you've not. But you've not consented to take part. Which makes it basically a giant ball, a giant can of worms. Either you get consent from everybody on the network to say, yes, you can use my work, or yes, you can use my feeds, or nobody provides informed consent, because you wouldn't be able to provide informed consent if your negative or your positive feed popped up in my newsfeed, because you aren't actually being manipulated. It's me who's being manipulated.
Something that I think is worth going into here is whether or not this being an experimental study actually justified itself. The thing about Facebook's algorithm is it randomly picks, I mean, the way the algorithm works, the way Facebook works, is it does not show you all of the content on your feed at any one time. It makes lots and lots of decisions as to how to display what it is, and some of those decisions will be essentially random. It will, there will be edge cases where something gets displayed or not by a minuscule amount of probability either way. In situations where researchers are told you can't perform an experiment, like political science is a big one, they've come up with wonderful ways to exploit these edge cases to have pseudo experiments where you don't have to actually intervene, but you can use statistical modeling to make to see the results as they would be if you had intervened. And that would sidestep a lot of these thorny issues. And it seems the fact that there's not really much discussion in this paper, the fact that Cornell's ethics board seemingly sidestepped the whole question of how this data set was put together, and the fact that Facebook think that it's okay for them to do it the whole time, makes me think that they just don't really even consider whether there are easier ways that don't involve manipulation of subjects. They just skip straight to, well, we've got these people, let's experiment on them. And I think that is a concerning precedent.
It's not a precedent that's in within this study. I mean, ultimately, that is psychological research.
It's the skipping straight to experimentation, which isn't, I mean, psychological research has, that there are hurdles to clear every time you want to do experimentation. Internally at Facebook, I think what this has shown is that doesn't seem to be the case. That inside Facebook, the hurdles to clear are, we're on the data science team, can we perform an experiment? Will it harm our advertising revenue? No. Okay, go for it. The only halter on this seemed to come when they tried to bring in Cornell people, and then Cornell's response was, the data set's already been put together, that's fine by us.
And this indeed is not the first study that Facebook has done. Mm-hmm. I think that there was another article that was released more recently that even said that the terms of service, that Facebook's terms of service actually didn't even include anything with regards to, we may even do research. Yeah. That could eventually be published outside. That's actually a Facebook issue rather than a research question mm-hmm. issue. That's a corporate issue as opposed to an academic issue. And I think that this is really where we get into these thorny issues, because research like this that is done online, there's at least 20 years of research that has been done online, that's psychological, that has looked at and has manipulated people's data, that has manipulated their experience in the same way that there is decades and decades of research that's experimented with people's behaviors and their attitudes mm-hmm. offline. The problem comes in, the ethical issue comes in, when academics work with or work outside the ivory tower, when they don't have complete control over their data set. You raised something that was very interesting, which is basically Cornell sidestepped the issue about how they got the data. And Facebook said, hey, this is how we do it. We're able to do it. Many, many research boards, academic research boards, actually encourage researchers to apply for money and often give people funding for what are called secondary data sets that they themselves haven't collected, but they want to then analyze. And does that then call into question whether such things should exist, that we should just get rid of all of secondary data sources?
Personally, I would wonder whether a data source which a researcher wouldn't be allowed by an ethics board to put together if they were given unlimited funding and the ability to do so, whether they should be allowed to use it just because someone else has put it together. I mean, there's obvious extremes you can go to, but fundamentally, it doesn't seem like Cornell's ethics board would have approved this researcher performing the experiment himself, but did say it was okay once Facebook had done it already. And that seems like a worrying sidestep of the issue. If Cornell's ethics board would have approved it, then I think Cornell's ethics board would be under quite a lot of fire as well today. They're already under fire for sidestepping the issue.
It's pretty easy to think of data sets that you could find which would have been collected unethically, which you might then wonder about whether you could do, you know, research on. I mean, you know, if you think back to data sets that might have been collected in the Second World War or something, it's very easy to imagine the scenarios where you'd have to confront that. And I would think that actually people might consider very carefully whether the people involved would be affected and what they would want to know. I mean, you know, I've been already been getting emails from people who say, you know, I started suffering from, you know, I started feeling depressed around this sort of time. Was Facebook doing something to me? And the fact that it, well, yeah, but the fact that it upsets people in this way is to some extent indicative.
But why are people focusing on the negative? Have you heard anybody say, hey, I started feeling really jolly and positive around this time as well? I
mean, we tend not to notice that, do we?
Facebook is all positive. You're meant to be happy on Facebook and a bit cynical and chin-strokey on Twitter. It just kind of naturally self-selects, doesn't it?
I don't know. I'm telling cheese jokes on Twitter.
You're telling very good cheese jokes on Twitter. I can tell you that. No, I do. I do actually think that there has been some really interesting dialogue around research ethics in the public sphere in a way that normally only I talk about it with my friends. At least on Twitter, people are actually starting to engage in this question. But my concern is that there might be a knee-jerk reaction to say, absolutely not. There should be no relationships between academic institutions and corporate environments. In many ways, it's actually a good thing that Cornell approached Facebook and said, please, can we at least make sense of this data that you're giving to us? Otherwise, we wouldn't have any sort of thoughtful analysis necessarily of the data that's been coming out of this corporate environment.
And also, I mean, your piece this morning, Charles, your comment in the paper, this study opens a can of worms in terms of whether we want these big social platforms to influence the way that we think, like a newspaper maybe does, or do we want them to be more neutral like broadcasters are required to be in this country politically.
But they can't be, can they? They if, as Alex was mentioning before, the algorithm that Facebook chooses to put forward various things on our news feeds, they're not neutral. You know, they always come from some kind of ideology. They always come from some kind of ideological platform.
Though that the fact that Facebook is a communications medium is part of what's at root as to why people are so instinctively creeped out about it. They all know that Facebook has a filtering algorithm, but Facebook has, you know, Facebook says, well, the algorithm is there to make Facebook a better communications medium. Essentially, that is at root of, you know, why they say they filter posts. We want to make it really good at communicating important stuff to you. When they come in, and I mean, we now know that at least for 1 week in January 2012 for 700,000 users, that was a lie. Facebook's algorithm did two things. It was there to surface the most important and interesting content for Facebook's users and to perform an experiment on them. And now if Royal Mail, another communications medium, comes along and says, normally our goal is to get posts to you, but for 1 week in January, our goal is to get posts to you and also withhold some posts to see how you react to it. The response to that is inherent to Royal Mail's nature as a communications medium. And I do think that that is important in Facebook. And perhaps the key difference between Facebook and something like Second Life. Second Life makes no implicit guarantees as to why it's delivering the information it does to you. Facebook, by virtue of being a communications medium, does. Perhaps what comes out of this is we all sit back and go, it's not. It's not a communications medium. We may use it to communicate, but that's secondary to the reason why Facebook exists, which is it's a publishing platform or it's an advertising platform that happens to let you publish on it.
But I think that this is probably going to turn out to be a landmark, and it's always dangerous to say this sort of thing, but I think this will be a landmark in how people view trust of social networks, big companies, big data companies like this, in terms of how far can you trust what you're seeing there? How much do you trust the companies? I mean, Larry Page was speaking last week and saying how frustrated he was that people don't trust big data companies more, that if they were allowed to do more data mining, that lots of lives could be saved through health data analysis. And I think that this example will be the counterexample of sort of, yeah, okay, maybe you could save those 100,000 lives, then again, might be 10,000, might be 10, might be 1. Maybe it'd be worse, maybe it'd just be more expensive. And against it, you have this of sort of, we're not quite sure what you're doing with stuff. You know, Facebook is meant to be the complete example of news. News where the definition is stuff I care about, stuff I want to pass on. And Facebook should be getting you the news in that sense. And if it's not doing that, if you can't be sure that you're not being experimented on at any given time, then that trust breaks down.
Very interesting discussion, and I managed to hold it together. So congratulations, everybody. We didn't incense me too much. I just do want to throw in a couple of interesting links. Somebody who's been thinking a lot about this for some time is the author Eli Pariser, who wrote a great book called The Filter Bubble, which a few years ago tried very much to talk about the underlying algorithms that are operating our social networks and also our search engines. And also, if you are interested in the ethics of psychology research online, I can point you to two resources. One is the Association of Internet Researchers ethics guidelines, and the other is the British Psychological Society's ethics guidelines, and I was involved in the latter. So thank you very much, and to read all the coverage of this story in a less academic context, go to theguardian.com/technology. Right, I'll tell you something that'll upset me more than seeing someone else's newsfeed updates. Not being able to see the newsfeed update. Like all internet junkies, I'm hooked on being able to get online. It is like running water, and if it's not there, I either throw my router across the room or I call someone to fix it. Earlier this week, users of BT's broadband service were unable to access the web, which I'm sure caused more than a few routers to be chucked across the room. Joining us in the studio to tell us what happened is Juliet Garside. So, Juliet, what did happen? What happened this week with BT?
So, towards the weekend, a lot of users all around the country, there wasn't kind of a geographical pattern They were in Cornwall, Eastbourne, Preston, Tunbridge Wells, started reporting that they couldn't access some of the big sites on the internet, so Amazon, eBay, Netflix, Facebook, Twitter, but also some British sites, so HSBC was a problem, some small business. One plumber reported his website was down, BT's own website was down for a bit. So I guess these things happen, don't they? They happen quite a lot on mobile networks as well. What seems to have brought this to the national news agenda's attention was the fact that BT apologised for it. Perhaps they don't do that so often. And so, I don't know, maybe it was quite news day on tech at the BBC, but they certainly picked it up and ran with it. But I think it does highlight some interesting things. One, as you say, internet's a utility. We all get a bit upset when we can't get onto it. And it can cause real problems if you're a small business. The plumbers said they had people in the office sitting there twiddling their thumbs because the calls weren't coming in. Or if you need to do some banking urgently and you can't get onto your website, that could be a real pain.
So how long was the service out? And was it a blanket? I think it was
intermittent, and it lasted for a 24-hour period, I think. But I was having a look actually at a website today which records issues, and BT was having new problems today. I think it was slightly higher level last week, perhaps big enough for them to think they ought to apologise, but it was intermittent, so you can't say it was kind of blanket outage.
What was the response?
I think certainly once the BBC picked up on it, big, you know, people were tweeting, people were logging complaints on a website called Down Detector. And Twitter and Down Detector actually seemed to have realised there was something big going on before BT's own customer service people or BT at all, because somebody was saying that they'd contacted customer service and was told it was just a local issue or perhaps an issue with their equipment. So the message wasn't going out to complainers at the same time as it was appearing on early warning sites like Down Detector.
Well, it's interesting, Juliet, isn't it, that we were talking about contagions before, and this, you know, the powerful response that the Peanut Gallery had after the BBC picked up the story about BT's broadband going down. Could that have had quite a massive effect on people's attitudes, on their trust for this service?
There's two bits to BT. There's the bit that runs the network and the bit that sells the consumer the internet service. And I get this was more on the side of the consumer arm. And so as a brand, yes, it can be damaging. But as internet users in the UK, we don't have a lot of option except to use BT's network unless we're on Virgin, because it's more or less a monopoly when it comes to the areas that Virgin doesn't reach. Virgin reaches about 50% of the UK population. But there is a sense of a lack of accountability. They do have a new guy running Openreach, Joe Garner, who is quite... He comes from a marketing and a banking background. He's quite customer-facing. But he doesn't have an email address he has an email address, but he doesn't have a customer service team that you or I can ring if our BT engineer is late. Because you see, if I'm on Sky or TalkTalk, I still need the one from BT, the BT engineer, to come and fix fault on my line or install a new line. So regulators are trying to do something else. They're trying to make sure that Openreach is getting to faults quicker and installing lines quicker. And it's going to have to fix most faults within 2 working days, and it's going to have 12 working days to repair most lines. But actually, it only has to meet that target for the new installs in 55% of cases when the rules come in. And it'll get to 80%, but only 80% by 2016, so in 2 years' time. So they have a particular issue with new builds, for example, and they find it quite hard to get internet out to those, and people in London have been waiting as long as 9 months for a broadband line from BT. And they, you know, they could get Virgin, but not always. So you know, that could continue being an issue for people for quite a while.
Would this inspire smaller startups to produce the goods?
And it's starting to happen. And TalkTalk is doing it at the moment with a company called CityFibre, I think. And CityFibre already lays cables in the ground for councils and businesses. And what it's doing in York is as a pilot project, which I think they genuinely want to roll out with TalkTalk and Sky, is they're connecting up the central homes in that city in one particular area. Then they're going to go area by area through York, and not just and they're putting fibre all the way to the home. BT's only goes to the cabinet, and then you're on copper for the rest of the way. It's a bit slower. So and they've got funding. They had a £50 million funding round recently on the strength of partly of this project, which is going to be rolled out if it's successful. I think at least from TalkTalk's point of view, they're quite keen to own more infrastructure, to own an alternative to BT's infrastructure. And they know that if they can bring their customers onto the network, it's viable.
And Charles, we've spoken briefly about alternatives to cable and fiber and tearing up your street. I think that we've spoken about Wi-Fi broadband?
Wi-Fi isn't really... I mean, you still need the backhaul. You still need to go over some sort of fiber backbone. So Wi-Fi tends not to be practicable, but there have been suggestions that LTE, forms of LTE and 4G at the 800 megahertz frequency could be used to provide high-speed broadband, but not need a landline. So those would be provided by a mobile carrier, or indeed BT, I think, bid for some. But I don't think it got the low frequency.
No, it didn't. There's right. an outfit called UK Broadband, who are based on the South Bank, and they want to give you 4G instead of a phone home broadband.
Yeah. I mean, with the suggestion that landlines are basically dying off, that people just aren't using them to make phone calls so much these days.
So why would you pay line rental to BT?
So why is it you have to pay a line rental to BT? Generally, because you need to get, because you want to have broadband. And why do you want broadband? Well, it's because you can't get it in a wireless form. Mm-hmm. The sort of limits that you have on your mobile broadband through your phone or whatever are too parsimonious to allow you to do much. So with the data that people want increasing, BT basically has people over a barrel, which is why it likes to hold on to Openreach, because it's a good money source. But in terms of LTE and broadband, could be a couple of years off yet.
Yeah, and the retail arm is getting massive now. With $2 billion worth of spend on sports rights and broadcasting, you're talking about an outfit that is similar to Sky in terms. Well, owns a lot of content, owns a lot of customers. Sky doesn't, it owns some satellites, but that's not a very valuable distribution network. The arguments for hiving off Openreach, the bigger the BT retail side gets, grow.
You can read all of Juliet's telecoms coverage on The Guardian. That's at theguardian.com. Recently, it was rumored that Twitter were in the market for a stylish social audio playing site and had eyes for one in particular from the Berlin-based SoundCloud. You may be listening to us now on SoundCloud, but if not, you'll have come across its iconic orange and white themed player at some point, as it's almost a default for the music industry when showcasing new music. In the last few days, they've made radical changes and updates to their mobile app. To talk me through this and what it means for our relationship between production and consumption online, I'm joined down the line by Guardian Apps expert Stuart Dredge to tell us some more. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us.
That's okay, hello.
Hi, so tell me, what's changed?
Well, it's had a very spangly revamp. So it's very much focused around listening now. So when they originally launched their app, it was about recording sounds and uploading it as well as listening. But now it's very much about discovering the kind of music and comedy and spoken words on SoundCloud. And kind of it serves you up to the stream of stuff you're following and stuff people are that's trending. So you can sort of turn it on, start playing, and then you're listening to a big stream of music for half an hour.
It sounds a little bit like existing radio apps. So it in the old days, it very much used to be something that you might record yourself and publish yourself. It was more of a publishing platform. So that sounds like quite a transformation in ambition.
It is, yeah. I mean, the what they're saying is they still want people uploading audio from apps, but they want to do it from other people's apps. So they'd rather have SoundCloud as a feature in other things that you record, whether it's a music app or a podcasting app or kind of a journalist app. So, yeah, it's kind of coming into the area of things like the radio elements of Spotify or in the US, Pandora, where it's kind of a personalized radio station of new stuff.
Why is this change happening? Is it because big names are coming to the site? Eric Walforce, who's the CEO, made no bones about the fact that he really wanted this to break new music, and they did with Lorde, for example, the pop singer. So is this why they're starting to do it? That they're thinking, hold on a second, we don't need to be MySpace, we can be Pandora.
I think so. I mean, I think it's got this huge catalogue of music, and it's been really interesting over the last year, because the last year has seen a lot of, well, not a fair amount of artists publicly complaining about things like Spotify, saying you don't pay enough for streaming. Whereas SoundCloud, very quietly, it doesn't pay anything to artists. They put it up and it's purely promotional. But it's become this very important place to promote your music and get a name for yourself. Whether you are, I mean, Lorde is their big success story. I think Royals was part of a 5-track EP on SoundCloud. And then from there it grew and grew because blogs could embed it. It was very open, like everyone could kind of listen to it and pick up on the birds. So I think they've basically quietly built this really big catalogue. And it's also very much focused around new stuff. And there's a lot of exclusive remixes on there. And a lot of DJs and dance acts, particularly, when they make something new, they stick it on SoundCloud and get feedback straight away. And it's become kind of part of their feedback loop before it gets into traditional streaming sales kind of system. So I think this is kind of partly capitalizing on that. You really can. You can kind of dig into SoundCloud and spend a happy hour listening to stuff. And I think they're putting that at the front now and saying, yes, we're a place you come to listen, not just a place that you happen to come to if one of the artists you like posts a track.
So how is this going to change their business model? Because as you say, at the moment, they don't deal with royalties. Do they make money on pro accounts, for example?
Yes, in the past they made money from selling pro accounts to creators. So you can kind of get pro accounts to upload more stuff and everything. And then they're sort of shifting. They're still doing that, but I think they're also investigating advertising. When I interviewed Eric last week, their co-founder, he talked about native advertising and working with brands in ways that are more than just banner ads or audio ads. And I think that's happening. It's a good opportunity for them because they have a huge, I think it's 250 million people, although I think that's people who listen on other sites where there's something embedded as well as SoundCloud itself. But there is more pressure, I think, less so from artists saying pay us and more so from labels and the publishers in particular who operate for songwriters saying you need to start paying royalties because you are a big destination service. So I think in a sense that the business model, there's a big opportunity because they're a big audience, but there's also, I think, growing pressure steadily saying that you need to figure out how to make money and how to pass some of that on.
Now, lots of musicians and content creators are up in arms about this. There is one comment from SoundCloud's own site when it announced the app. It's quite harsh, actually. It says, "You obviously need a new product manager. Seriously, did you forget everything that made you unique? Shipping this app before implementing your core functionality, i.e., and this is me inputting it here, uploading, the opportunity to upload, is like serving dinner at a restaurant and forgetting to put the food on the plate." So this update is not, you know, it's not being welcomed with open arms by everybody.
I think so. It's hard to know from the outside how much of it that traditional social media thing of something's changed and I don't like it. I mean, Facebook gets it, whatever the new app that changes something will be. But yeah, I think there is obviously a need out there from creators saying, right, this is obviously an app for us to do anything with other than listen. I mean, in a way, when I interviewed them, they explained it quite well, I thought, and they were saying that there are all these other powerful apps for making music and for recording spoken word, and they're much better at the recording than we are. So we'd rather be an option for them to say, stick it on SoundCloud. And you're seeing that a lot. I've seen a few DJ apps doing it now, adding it as an option. So I don't think it's there's not going to be an option to upload your stuff from your phone. But yeah, clearly they're saying it's not us. And there is, I think there is some unease. And they have a very vocal community because artists and creators have really kind of grown up with this platform. So I think they feel quite invested in it. So when there was a change as big as this, I kind of understand why people are sitting there a bit slightly shocked and slightly worried. But I think it'll take a bit of time to shake out and figure out whether the alternatives are as good as SoundCloud is saying they are.
You can follow this story and all of Stuart's coverage on theguardian.com/technology. Stuart, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Fire Chat app is an instant messenger app. There are plenty of those out there. So what, Alex Hearn, does this one do that's different?
Well, what it does is it ignores the internet pretty much entirely, which is kind of a big sell for something which we think of as technology and appy. FireChat is basically a recreation of the AOL chat rooms of yore. You open up the app and you've got a long list of topics and you can enter a room and chat away with other people. And if you have an internet connection, that really is all it is. It's essentially a vaguely retro way of talking to strangers online. Where it gets interesting is if you don't have a connection. If, say, you're somewhere without the internet, sure, but also what interests me about it is if you're somewhere where a government or someone else who controls or can infiltrate the communications network has said, nope, no access to social media, no access to the internet in general. You are staying in our walled guardian. Because what FireChat can do then is one phone running FireChat can speak to another phone running FireChat, which is not hugely impressive, not much more than something like Bluetooth can do already. That's that second phone can speak to a third one, can speak to a fourth one, and it builds up a mesh network, which all of the phones in the network can enter this local chat room, have their nice chat completely off the grid, not un-eavesdroppable, in fact the exact opposite, there's no way they can prevent someone going on the same local network and reading, but fundamentally impossible to shut down. And that raises very, very interesting questions for people in situations like Iraq right now, Taiwan during the student protests, anywhere where the government is really, really trying to keep communications quiet.
Well, you met up with its creator, Misha Benoliel. Mm-hmm. Apologies for destroying that poor man's name. He is the CEO of San Francisco startup Open Garden. So tell me more.
Open Garden is the startup behind this technology. They came up with, just before Apple pushed a very similar technology, they came up with a way of doing this on Android, of building up a mesh network. FireChat began as a proof of concept. They weren't really setting out to revolutionize AOL-style chat rooms. It just seemed like the most obvious way you could build an app layer on top of this mesh networking technology. But fundamentally, their aim is grander. They want to revolutionize internet access worldwide. Google is spending billions putting essentially glorified weather balloons up over places without much internet access. Facebook is spending almost as much flying spy planes at satellite heights over to beam internet into areas. FireChat thinks that if you just have enough people with mobile phones running something like FireChat or running the Open Garden software, you don't really need anything expensive. The internet bounces in through this mesh network, bounces around the network, and bounces back out the other end.
So let me mangle his name once more. Let's hear from Misha Benoliel.
FireChat is a messaging app that enables you to message people around you, even when you don't have any cellular connectivity or internet access.
So how does that work? Phones speak directly to each other?
Absolutely. So your phone today, your smartphone, not only has a radio to connect to a cell tower, but it also has other radios like Wi-Fi or Bluetooth to connect to other devices around. And when smartphones are next to each other with FireChat, they directly interconnect.
So, I mean, how is this different from something like Bluetooth, which has been able to send short messages back and forth since the days of yore?
So the big difference is, even if wireless have been existing for a long time, the big difference is now the smartphones basically have the capacity to, that they can recognize each other completely seamlessly when they are nearby. They can interconnect and they can start to exchange information.
And so is this one-to-one, or are we talking a huge number of smartphones in the same area are all sending messages?
Both. It can be one-to-one, one-to-many. And in the case of FireChat, it's often, everyone in the same place that are exchanging messages locally, or people who are in the same location then exchanging also messages.
And so you call this, I mean, this is mesh networking, is that right? Is that the term for it?
We call it peer-to-peer mesh networking.
Okay. And so does that mean that, I mean, a mesh, like a net, does this mean that as well as speaking directly phone to phone, messages are routed from one phone to the other?
So the messages can, if you are connected to the internet, go through the internet, obviously. But if you are not, they can just go from one phone to the other. And they can hop. So that means the message can go from one phone to another phone that goes to another phone.
Okay. So you can even use it if my phone can't speak to yours, but there's a whole bunch of people between us, it can jump through them all.
Yes, it can.
Okay. And I mean, the technology behind it, when I first heard about FireChat, I knew it as an Apple thing. But what you've got to announce today is that it's you're going cross-platform. So how much of this technology is your own? How special is this to FireChat?
So when we developed this technology 3 years ago with Open Garden, so the company mm-hmm. behind FireChat, we started on the Android platform. And more recently, Apple, with the iOS 7, enabled to do more things with wireless interface. So we thought it was a good opportunity to start building an app that would take advantage of what Apple had done for iOS 7 and market it. And messaging was the perfect thing to do. And it worked pretty well. I mean, it was supposed to be a test when we launched the app, and we got a huge spike from the day one. And to the surprise of everybody, a few weeks after, we launched also the Android platform.
Okay. I mean, this new app, you're calling it FireChat less than 3, but FireChat Love, FireChat Heart. What else is it? Is cross-platform, is this the big change in it?
So the big change there is, and that's why we called it, the code name was FireChat less than 3, so FireChat Love, is because now Android devices or Android smartphones or tablets can talk to iOS devices, so iPhones or iPods or iPads directly without going through the internet. That's why it's called FireChat Love.
Okay. And I mean, it's coming out now in, what I'm counting up, 7 languages. Is there English, Chinese, French, German, Japanese, Russian and Spanish? Why have you picked these countries to launch in?
Because they are the countries where we have seen the most traction when we launched the app at the beginning. But now we are seeing traction. I mean, it really depends on the news and the events and what happened. Like, for example, during this weekend, we saw a spike in Iraq with more than 30,000 installs during the weekend.
Okay.
So it really depends on the news and what's happening. And we hope with the World Cup.
this is the thing. Do you think, I mean, what sort of use cases are you seeing for it? Are people downloading it, giving it a go, and then getting rid of it? Or are there situations in which it's becoming indispensable?
So there are many places where you can use FireChat where normally you wouldn't be able to message. You can use FireChat in the subway, in the tube. You can use it in an airplane. You can use it in a crowded place where normally you wouldn't have internet access, like concerts or some venues, conferences. And so it's these are all the places where normally you wouldn't be able to message people. And more than that, FireChat, you can use it also all the time because you have these thematical chat rooms that you can create and invite people to join these chat rooms.
So in some ways, we're talking about something that people can use just like WhatsApp as a normal messaging app because it still goes through the internet. But then if you're in one of these weird situations where you need to speak to someone but you have no internet but you've both got your phones, that's where FireChat really comes into its own.
Absolutely. It's much more pervasive than a normal other messaging app. And so even if you don't have access to the internet in these situations, we'll be able to keep on communicating with FireChat.
And, I mean, was it 60,000 downloads in Iraq? You said
30,000 in Iraq.
30,000.
Yeah.
Those 30,000 downloads in Iraq, I mean, are these people, I would guess these are people trying to find a way of getting around the dispute in that country, trying to find a way of getting around.
It's people who want to stay in touch with their friends and also keep on being informed on what's happening.
How much use have you seen of FireChat in places that are having unrest?
So we saw a big spike, for example, in Taiwan during the student protest because the government was threatening to shut down the internet, and we went number one in the App Store. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Iraq now is the second country in terms of usage just after the United States. So it's a big spike.
Okay. Is that interesting for you that you've got these two very different groups of users? On the one hand, you've got Americans who are using it as a vaguely light messaging app. On the other hand, places like Thailand, places like Iraq, where your lifeline.
I mean, messaging, everyone is affected and everyone uses messaging every day. Mm. So it's really a global play. Now, because this app has a specific identity which is linked to enabling messaging in places where normally you cannot message people, then you have, that's why we explain we have these spikes that are linked to the news and what's happening. But it's meant to be an entertaining app, I mean an app for entertainment at the beginning, so it can be used by everyone, and we are happy that people got so excited when we launched, and now we are working on improving the user experience and obviously bring more features to the user. Because it was a test at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things that interests me. So it was, you spent 2.5 years developing the technology before you even launched FireChat at all as Open Garden. What is there in this technology that you can do beyond simply chat, beyond the simple test that you released?
So what's interesting with the peer-to-peer mesh networking technology is you can enable connectivity in places where normally there was no connectivity. You can, in places like in Europe, in all the countries, or US, you can improve connectivity for everyone. But you can also, in places where there is no infrastructure at all, enable people to build what I call like local internet that can or not connect to the bigger internet. So you enable people to grow their own internet.
So, I mean, essentially, this could solve quite a lot of the problems about getting connectivity to developing countries. Google's launching balloons for this. Facebook's launching, what are they, spy planes, essentially. Are you a third way? Is this, if everyone in Kenya has something like FireChat on their mobile phones, they don't even need really expensive infrastructure building. They can just do that.
So that's how we position Open Garden today. We believe there is the traditional players in the connectivity, so all the carriers, the mobile operators. There is a new breed of players like the Google or the Facebook that are coming to the market with a solution that require billions of dollars of investment and which can be also sometimes very experimental. We are very pragmatic with our approach. We turn every smartphone, every smart device into a router, into an internet node. And this can be done with no investment thanks to a simple app that is completely free. And that's the big disruption with Open Garden and the big disruption with FireChat, which people really understand because it is about messaging and everyone is messaging every day.
I mean, in terms of it being free, how does Open Garden profit from this? What's your motivation?
So our first motivation has always been to provide free internet and enable freedom of speech to a maximum number of people. But we are a company, and we want to keep our apps completely free for the end users. So the way we are generating money is by enabling partners who are generating revenues through the extra connectivity we provide. And that way, basically, we charge our partners for every dollar they make when normally they wouldn't be able to make it because they are not connected to a cellular tower or to a Wi-Fi hotspot.
What else do you think that you could use this mesh networking for in the future beyond just, is FireChat just text chat right now?
So with FireChat, you can exchange text, you can exchange pictures, so videos, any content. We believe it's only the beginning of what we call the proximal application field. Means that application that can leverage the proximity of other people. And we will keep on launching other apps in the future that will leverage this.
What's the biggest mesh network you've made so far? How many phones just communicating with no connection to the internet?
So in the case of FireChat, we don't know because nothing comes back to our server. In the case of Open Garden, we participated to a few conferences, and during a conference in San Francisco last year, I think we gathered close to 150, 200 users in the same place.
But as far as you know, there's no reason why it couldn't be the case that if everyone in London downloaded and opened up FireChat, why I couldn't send a message from North London all the way to South London pinging through phones.
So that's our goal. And when you look at some projections we made to figure out which would be the magic number, which is the penetration ratio we should reach among people in an urban area, we arrived to a theoretical number, which is 7 to 8% of the population in an urban area, to enable you to be connected to someone else more than 93% of the time.
That low, and it would be okay. Just 7 or 8%.
In theory, I believe the number is higher.
Probably higher.
But
in practice,
if you look at famous gaming apps that reach like 60% penetration ratio, we are still far from that number.
Yes. How does it work in the background? If I have FireChat, does it have to be open to be relaying messages?
So FireChat runs in the background. Depending on the platform, if it's Android or iOS, the app will behave differently. Mm-hmm. In the FireChat Love, so FireChat less than 3 version, you're going to be able to have notifications when people are nearby or send you messages and you're not on the app. Yeah.
Okay. Like you say, it's a disruptive piece of technology. You're trying to change what Google and Facebook are going after. You're trying to usurp WhatsApp, you're trying to usurp Line. Have you seen any resistance from companies or governments or anyone else?
First, I want to comment on what you said, because I think the more capacity big players bring on the market regarding internet access, so the Facebook, the Google, or the traditional carriers, that's great, and we need more and more capacity. But as it is disruptive technology, obviously, when we started at the very beginning, we saw some resistance from some mobile operators, carriers. But if you look in the past and with what happened with software like Skype, for example, you quickly realize that it's the first normal reaction that people have in an industry when you are disrupting the industry, and then after they embrace this new technology and can figure out the benefit.
One last question, which I always close interviews like this with, is do you think it's going to change the world?
Then? Definitely. We believe that's a technology that's going to change the whole world.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read Alex's article on the FireChat app, plus the best coverage, of iOS and Android apps on the web at theguardian.com/technology. That's all we have for you this week. Thank you very much to Alex, Charles, Juliet, and of course the rest of the tech team. Thank you very much for listening, and do come back next Wednesday for more when I promise not to be so incensed. From me, Alex Kratosky, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's bye for now.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. With World Cup fever taking over, we at The Guardian are pretty sure that you're thinking big too. So maybe now is the time to use Squarespace to create your own professional website for your small business, portfolio, or blog. It's easy. You could create your own site during halftime. Just go to squarespace.com to start your free trial. And to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.